start the discussion session. And it should be similar to the one that we had yesterday. There are a few differences. So yesterday we had a full hour. This time we have 45 minutes. We're also running 15 minutes late, so we will extend a little bit just because the program was a bit longer and the coffee break. So the plan is that we also have additional talks like we had last time, because we had so many talks today that are stimulating this discussion and giving a lot of input now.
Discrepancies of H0 from the measurements of the early and late universe. And as Adam explained, we have several new physics explanations for this. And all of those are modifying the Hubble rate in the early universe. And he was briefly going through these different possibilities. Some of them are better than others, with reconciling this early universe data with the late universe data for H0. This is actually an older plot from a previous talk by Adam, but it was very similar in his talk today. So the first possibility was that dark energy might not be a cosmological constant, but we would have a non-zero omega A parameter. The second possibility was to have a sterile neutrino state, which raises an effective, but as we heard both by Adam and by George, this is causing issues with Planck, so we can only marginally raise an effective. There were other possibility would be to change slightly the curvature, which is also only giving a slight improvement. And then there were two possibilities of having dark matter interactions proportional to the mass of the dark matter particle, or to have early dark energy. So a constant dark energy contribution in the early universe that's then decaying away like radiation or faster at a redshift of 3,000 or higher. But as we heard already by George, is that, yeah, the parameters that are chosen are from a model building point of view also questionable. So we want to discuss today, like, what kind of new physics could be hidden in this tension, or whether there is new physics at all, and how we can reconcile those different values. So this should be the main part of the discussion today. And I would like to add like another 10 more minutes or so, depending on how the interest of the audience is, to all the other discrepancies that we have for cosmological parameters. So I think this is an incomplete list, and some of you might be very excited about some of these topics. Some people don't think there are no additional tensions at all. So this is a matter of taste, but I think it would be interesting to have an additional discussion on, for example, the small-scale dark matter problems. We heard yesterday in a contribution by Azemina Avanitaki that there are small-scale dark matter problems like the cusp core, missing satellites, or too big to fail problems. So this is one example for the cusp core problem. So the cold dark matter simulation gives a prediction for the density distribution in dwarf galaxies that's deviating from what we're measuring. So this is taken from a review from 2017. And it was discussed yesterday whether some of those small-scale dark matter problems could be resolved actually by new physics. So dark matter could not be cold, but could be warm or fuzzy or self-interacting or superfluid. For example, if dark matter was self-interacting, we would heat up the core of those dwarf galaxies and would flatten out this density distribution, just as we observe in the data. However, we don't know whether these problems might simply dissolve if we get new data, or whether we have lambda CDM explanations of those problems that we still haven't found yet. For example, the missing satellites could just be dark, for example, so we can't see them. Then George mentioned a few CMB odds or CMB anomalies. And as he said, they're all at the 2 to 3 sigma level. So I just picked up two different examples that we have a hemispherical power asymmetry, and we have a lack of large angle correlations. And we have a few more that are all at this low significance range. So most people don't think there's any new physics hidden in there, but this is something, if you're interested, we could also further discuss about, or have George comment on these other kind of CMB anomalies. And finally, we heard yesterday by Maxime that the 21 centimeter line experiment edges has observed an absorption signal that is not really explainable with lambda CDM. So it's a factor 2 off the lambda CDM prediction, and this was what he was discussing, a possible dark photon explanation of this anomaly. And then there are further discrepancies, like the missing baryon problem was claimed to be solved last year. For the missing pulsar problem in the galactic center, it could be that it's just not observable because of the very high density of dark matter in the galactic center. So we don't know whether any of these discrepancies here are really pointing towards new physics, but they have been discussed very widely in the community. So I think it would be interesting to have another 5 or 10 minutes at the end of this discussion devoted to these kinds of tensions. And the speakers are all here, like Maxime, for example, and Adam and George remotely. So I would like to open the discussion now. So just continue the questions to Adam and to George and the other speakers we've heard today and yesterday, or to share your own opinions about these discrepancies, whether they really point towards new physics and what kind of problems and advantages exist of the different new physics interpretations. So, you have a contribution?
Yeah. Regarding the second slide.
Yes.
Like a long time, I know the physicists who look at the thing from a different point of view. Namely, is gravity modified as far as fits to galaxies and clusters of the sun? And having published a lot of papers on this based on a modified gravity theory I have, I would say that getting rid of the dark matter for satellites for the galaxies and clusters removes the problems of the cusp core using satellites too big to fail. So on the other hand, that's not enough to fit galaxies and clusters with modified gravity. You also have to explain the perfect cosmological data as described by George. And I believe it's possible to do this. I have a forthcoming paper that attempts to do this. So the whole issue of dark matter is open, because we don't detect dark matter particles to date. And that's the big question. How long do we continue looking for dark matter particles but not detecting them? What does this mean? Maybe we have to look for theory, for example, gravity theory, which explains why we don't detect dark matter particles. If as such, it turns out eventually that that's the case.
So, as Adam mentioned in his talk, the modified gravity theories currently can't explain like all the different observations, especially the CMB that we have. So, then we look forward to the paper that is upcoming. Okay, so does anyone want to comment on that or has further questions? If not, okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think I have a question for George. This issue with the difference in parameters for less than 800 and bigger than 800, I'm just curious, how big of a significance do you put on that? I mean, quantitatively, is it that you think it's 2.5 sigma or more or less?
Yes, okay, so I haven't tried to, combine the parameters. I mean, you can see in TT, there's no example where you're outside the one sigma contours, right? Okay, so it's not a very statistically significant result. It's a little worse when you add in the polarization. Okay. But, it's just not a very significant result. But the key thing is, if you don't have the low multiples, if you only have multiples of, 800 to 2,500, it's really difficult. Okay. You lose control of NS and the NS blows up, okay, and so it's difficult. What this really is doing it's a really, really good test of the consistency of your likelihood. Okay, if you can make sense of this, then you know, there isn't any obvious, you know, problem with your likelihood or your foreground model.
Then I have another.
It has a bearing on polarization experiments. Okay, you know, you know, future, you know, Simon's polarization, et cetera, I think that they have to be self-contained experiments. They should try and sample enough of a multiple range, okay, so they don't have to combine with Planck. Because once you try and combine with Planck, you're going to go into all sorts of really difficult issues to do with polarization calibration. For ground-based experiments and for Planck, the polarization calibration for Planck is not good. Okay. So I think that people have to work, you know, they should design the experiments to be self-contained and cover a wide enough multiple range.
So I have just a question about the question for Adam. Looking at this plot, for example, one thing that's a little bit confusing if you look on the side with the low Z measurements is that there are quite large error bars for all those measurements.
Yeah.
If you look at those center mean values, they're all kind of on top of each other. And
so, yep.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so I can answer that. So this probably isn't the plot. I probably would have shown the plot from the various different experiments, because those are independent things that you can actually compare. In this case, this was a plot just showing how our results had changed by adding things. And so most of these data sets are cumulative. And so that, as a result of that, you don't expect the central value to change very much.
But there was a plot that you showed in your talk where you sort of were trying to show how consistent that HNO measurements were. Right. You had this sort of...
Those have large overlaps, because what you're doing in each case is you're eliminating a data set, right? You're saying, it's like a jackknife test. You're saying, all right, I'm going to throw out one data point. What happens to everything? And in a jackknife test, everything stays very well contained unless you throw out the critical data point and then everything changes. And so, again, that's, you know, the only time you really want to look and say, okay, are these things varying enough, is when they're actually independent. None of those things are. I mean, what it is fair to look at is, you know, the different experiments, you know, masers in Hubble flow versus holy cow versus, you know, pick a type 1a supernova distance ladder versus SBF. You know, those are things that are not overlapping. And so there, that would be the plot I would show you for that. Same thing is true in some cases for the CMB, that, you know, if you're using BAO each time, then, you know, they're not going to jump around as much either.
So also on this slide, you have two numbers up there for dark energy, not lambda. What is the meaning of 0.08 and 0.8?
Yeah. So there's you know, there's an infinite number of ways to make dark energy not lambda, but the two most obvious ways are to say it's a constant equation of state, just not minus one. So you shift it by minus 0.08, meaning minus 1.08 would be the new equation of state. Or, sure, it's minus one now, but it has a derivative. It's been changing with redshift. And so there, you know, that's more poorly constrained, but it has less effect as well. So something like a change in what we call WA is the sort of changing term by minus 0.8, whereas we expect it to be zero for lambda CD. So either one of those.
That could also maybe be combined with the early energy idea, right? That's some kind of variation.
Yeah, well, I think most people think it's ugly to start adding multiple new physics.
I mean the same physics.
Yeah.
Explaining perhaps dark energy changing.
I mean, this dark energy there is linked to dark energy.
You put them in two different categories. I'm just wondering.
Well, you want to tie them together?
Suppose you
could. Okay, well, I mean, what's happening at redshift, you know, 0.5, and the other is at redshifts, you know, 3000 or something. So, and unless somebody has a model or idea of how those become related.
I mean, has anyone tried just some power laws?
So I just to explain that, I mean, the point is that first thing is like a Taylor expansion. You're doing a Taylor expansion today, but then extrapolating that Taylor expansion all the way to redshift 1000 doesn't seem to make much sense. And I don't think you actually can solve it. You really want something that's kind of not there at all, or I guess it's a lambda, and suddenly does something very weird at redshift of 10,000.
I mean, suppose there were power with some 1 or 2 parameters giving you both early dark energy and something decaying close to what we see now.
But there will be very different types of parameters, right? This is the problem, like, because one does things at late time, the other does things. So you could do that, and the problem is, I mean, I think they're pretty much decoupled from each other, as far as I know.
I mean, just a general comment to make. I mean, I'll just say about the tension, and I mean, this hopefully was clear in my talk. I mean, the reason that I think it's hard to avoid is because you could take many different data sets or experiments or methods at either early or late time. I mean, all of these measurements are complicated enough. Nobody is, you know, can't swear there isn't an error in somebody's code or something in analyzing some data. So, you know, what you have to have at the end of the day to really be sure is the ability to eliminate everything. And what I think makes it hard to avoid this conclusion is that that is true now in both ends of this, at late and at early times. So I don't know how to avoid this conclusion. That doesn't mean I have an explanation. I agree with everything George said, that, you know, an explanation can't make other parts of the data fit worse. Otherwise, you're just trading one tension for the other. You're not winning anything. And, you know, we all sort of have a tendency to think there'll be one thing that'll, you know, get you there. I also am not so, you know, don't have so much confidence in our theoretical ability right now to think that, you know, it has to be the set of things that we can think of right now either. I mean, it could be something, you know, that sits around for a while until somebody figures out, I don't know. Or it could be that another data set, like a CMB data set, actually sees additional features. I mean, I don't know if George thinks there's any chance that any of the A sub L or variation in parameters, as modest as it is with L, could be a signature, or, you know, later on after we see the right answer, we'll say, oh yeah, that was some hint of that in terms of, you know, early scalar fields.
So John was mentioning after your talk this paper by Friedman and others with the calibration with the tip of the red giant branch. So you said you redid the calibration and you found a different value. So,
So tip of the red giant branch, like any standard candle, needs to be calibrated. So tip of the red giant branch. So I talked a lot about consistency in our measurements using the same telescope and the same method to calibrate so it drops out. In their case, they did tip of the red giant branch in supernova hosts in the halos of galaxies with HST. So halos of galaxies are very low extinction. That's great. And with HST, good telescope, that's great. But then they have to calibrate it somewhere. And so they calibrated it in the Large Magellanic Cloud. The Large Magellanic Cloud is not a big galaxy with a halo. And so they used ground-based telescopes to do that. That's not the same telescope. And most importantly, there is extinction, quite significant, of TRGB. And it's always been challenging for astronomers to estimate extinction, how much there is. So if you use the standard, I would say, measures of extinction people have used for the LMC, then you get H0 of 72.4 for TRGB, using everything else exactly the same. And this was written up in a paper by Juan et al. A few weeks ago. In order for them to get the extinction they got, they used three things, which I probably would not recommend. One is this contaminated blended data from Zeritsky. Two was they compared TRGB at colors where it's not metallicity insensitive. And three, the model fit they get is actually quite a bad fit. It's like chi-square of 16 with three free points. That's a bad fit. And so normally, you know, you wouldn't trust something that comes out of that. So I think the case is stronger that you do get a higher value for TRGB. And in general, other papers in the literature have also gotten higher values. So,
Adam, could I ask a question about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I mean, they used Ogle Cepheids, right? For the LMC.
They used a mix, and the problem is the mix that they used. They used Ogle data for TRGB in the LMC, and then they compared it to Zeritsky data.
Yeah.
In the SMC.
Right. Okay. But
if they used Ogle in both places, then I think they would have gotten the canonical answer.
But the extension in the LMC is patchy.
It is.
And we have extinction measures. So couldn't you define a mask in the LMC, just eliminating the, you know, the highly extinct parts?
Right. Well, right. So you could use, you have to use a reddening. I mean, you have to have some way of saying which areas are have higher extinction and which areas have lower extinction. So
yeah.
The Ogle reddening maps give you a map over the entire LMC based on red clump stars.
That's right.
And red clump stars are red giants. So that seems like a very appropriate population for TRGB. So you could pick, as you said, lower extinction regions. This may sound surprising, but it's actually the bar of the LMC that has the lowest extinction, not the...
Yeah, there's sort of patch in the left-hand side, lower left-hand of center where the extinction is highest.
That's right.
So what happens if you just get rid of that high extinction
patch? So then you get pretty much, and if you look at a paper by Jang and Li, 2017,
yeah.
They use the bar because A, it has low extinction, and B, most importantly, that's the same location where the detached eclipsing binaries are. See, if you move away from the detached eclipsing binaries, then you also have to make a geometric correction for the orientation of the LMC. So if you take what Jang and Li got in 2017, that gives HNOT of 72.4. And that was using the bar, using the regions closest to detached eclipsing binaries, and using the Ogle reddening maps.
Mm-hmm.
So Wendy Friedman is not present.
Yes.
If she were, what would she say to his?
Yes. She would say, well, we think we have a better method of measuring the reddening. We're measuring it directly to the stars. And she would say, we have a paper in preparation because they pointed, when they explain the details of it, they actually don't explain the details, but they say, see a paper in preparation. And she would say, you know, you'll have to wait for a paper in preparation or something like that. I guess I would say, because that's where the explanation, more explanation is.
She hasn't given up.
She
hasn't given up on 69.8.
So their paper came out a month and a half ago, and this follow-up paper, which I was a co-author on, came out 3 weeks ago. And then there's been nothing else stated since then. However, let me add this too. I think a better place to calibrate tip of the red giant branch is probably NGC 4258, because you don't have to deal with this extinction in the LMC issue. And NGC 4258's halo is observed with HST. So it's apples to apples with where you apply TRGB. And so you can look at this recent paper by Reed. I'm a co-author of it as well. And when we use NGC 4258 to derive the TRGB calibration and apply it to Friedman's, you know, rest of her machinery, we get 71.1. So, you know, all these things are relatively close. But, you know, generally I would say TRGB gives 71 to 72. But if you looked at the table that I showed today, even if you include Friedman's value with no changes, with everything else that is independent of it, you're still over 4 sigma. So that's why I'm saying there's really no way to evade this discrepancy. Even if you want to throw out one data set, you just can't start throwing out multiple data sets. Otherwise, by definition, you've thrown away all your knowledge.
If we could move her number up to 74, if we couldn't move her number up to 74, then this would be very significant.
Yeah, well, not
86.
Right. Well, not, I showed that as well. Not using any TRGB, because you can't use Cepheids and TRGB at the same time. They're doing the same job. So, you know, you want to use one or the other. So if you use Cepheids, you're at 5.7 sigma. So, and the Holy Cow team used simply their strong lensing measurements and our distance ladder with Cepheids, and they claim, this was like 2 months ago, they claimed it's 5.3 sigma. So I'm just saying TRGB, the way they're doing it and throwing away our data would bring it down from 5-something sigma to 4-something sigma. But you're not getting out of this in either case.
Could I just make a point about theoretical explanations? Because the lambda CDM, the standard lambda CDM number is 67.5 plus or minus 0.5. And most of the theoretical explanation will struggle to get you anything above 70. Okay, so from the point of view of, you know, theory, if the true answer was 71, we'd have a significant problem.
There's the papers by Poulin and Smith and the Harvard group, Rock and Roll, whatever. Anyway, they're about 71 to 72. They're not 73 or 74, but they are 71 or 72.
The point that I'm making is it's quite hard to shift. Okay, so a shift of 3 kilometers per second per megaparsec would involve exotic physics. That's the point. 6 kilometers per second would be even more exotic physics, but 3 kilometers per second per megaparsec would be exotic physics nonetheless.
But having dark matter interactions doesn't sound too exotic. So is this model a very specific one? Assuming
I can't remember which paper that is. Maybe somebody else here knows. I want to say Celine Bohm, but I'm not sure. But I think this is
dark matter neutrino interactions. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This may be a different philosophy than some people. I think we sometimes make a mistake in trying to come up with a theoretical explanation while judging the size of the observational discrepancy. I mean, I almost think, one should have a firewall between those, that we can do a measurement and an experiment. I mean, this is sort of what we want to do, is in some ways be blinded to what the consequences are when doing a measurement and do the measurement as best you can. And so, I've been pretty honest that I don't have an explanation for this, but I do think that the observational signal is very strong. And I think, we don't do the best job in either case, well, in particularly judging the observations by thinking, do I know an explanation yet? I mean, there's been plenty of times in the physics world where, we had some observational phenomenon stick around for 30, 40, 50 years, Mercury precession, solar neutrino problem, on and on and on. And I'm not saying that, this history doesn't tell us what the answer here is either. I'm just saying, I hear people often have creep across the boundary of do I understand it? Well, then is it possible? I mean, I've seen, not going to make fun of Bobby Lowe, but since he isn't here, telling me recently at a conference, he doesn't have a theoretical explanation for this, therefore he does not believe the observation. And, that's an extreme point of view, but, it is a view shared by some people. I accept that we can observe, do an experiment and observe something without understanding why yet.
The universe is cleverer than us.
Yes, exactly. more than maybe not you, George.
You had a comment on that?
With regard to just a quick question on it. So what I at least understand with the dark matter is sort of after matter dominance, the anisotropy piece in the dark matter grow like A, and then presumably because it's radiation dominated before, and you assume the dark matter is kind of moving over the energy density and it goes like 1 over A to the fourth, but they're fixed, they're static. In these models where you have some interaction here with the neutrinos of themselves, does that mean that the growth of anisotropies could depend on A or even decay while it's interacting with the neutrinos? Is that what these models imply? Because that would be, it seems like to me that would also affect what the power spectrum measurement, if you have a
I think I'm not entirely sure about this dark matter theory, but I think some of these interacting dark matter models, they want to solve both the sigma tension at the same time as Hubble tension. So, and the sigma tension is indeed what you were talking about, that the amplitude of, basically the tension is at a low redshift, the amplitude of fluctuations is not quite what you expect from CMB. And yeah, so I think the answer is yes.
But usually the models that try to solve the sigma A tension are worsening the H naught tension. So that's like if you have like higher neutrino mass.
Paper by Melchiori, I think, is dark matter, dark energy interaction. That is saying that you solve both of them at the same time. So that's the one that I recall. But I don't remember my neutrino.
No, but that doesn't work very well, right? In that recent Melchiori paper, they just neglected the BAO data. And
but nobody trusts BAO data, right?
Sorry?
It's you're not here, so you're not getting the joke. Sorry, George. I'm sitting next to Bill Percival, so that's why I'm biased.
Oh, okay.
He was having to go with me, George. Don't worry about it.
Sorry, if they put in the BAO data, it would kill those models. Okay, so there'll be a paper too where they put in the BAO data and they find that the model doesn't work.
Okay.
We've had recent some rather bloomers in physics. I'm referring to which was mentioned during this meeting. The particle physicists discovered a second Higgs, 750 GeV, and some Higgs decay to gamma. It was 6 sigma. And embarrassingly enough, it just disappeared. It was a fluctuation. We have primordial gravitational wave debacle. And that was a sensation which vanished rapidly. And that was several sigma. So one has to be careful not to repeat this.
I mean, there will be a lot of new data in the next 10 years, so the discussion will continue, but yeah.
But
we still, I mean, it's several different experiments and...
Just a funny note about sigmas.
Okay.
So we, in cosmology, right, we end up inheriting a lot from particle physics, right, the particle physics world, and this is sort of what I've learned, is, you know, there's this historic preference for 5 sigma, let's say, right? And... you know, particle physicists usually are used to looking for a bump in energy in a particle physics experiment where they don't know what energy to expect. And so they want to make sure that they aren't being led astray by, you know, a false signal. And so in that case, there's a huge look elsewhere effect because they don't know what energy. They have many rolls of the dice available to them to get their signal. I would say we only have one universe in this case. You know, we aren't looking at, you know, 100 different realizations of the universe and seeing, you know, a difference in a parameter for just one of them. This is just the one that we have. And so, you know, in many ways, you know, less sigma is much more significant in cosmology than it is for particle physics, just because we only get one roll of the die.
Well, the bump, the Higgs to 2 gamma spectrum was 5%. And the Nobel Prize was awarded in 2012, July. The size of the bump was 5%. And yet it led to the fact that it was a real event eventually, because now it's gone up to 10 or 11 sigma. But the big shouting and celebration, July 2012, was based on a 5% effect in the bump.
Yeah. Maybe in defense of particle physics. So in the Higgs discovery, we had multiple channels, which had very specific predictions for those channels. And in the gamma-gamma with two different experiments, the sort of anomaly was is that we just ignored the discrepancies between the two experiments. They had different widths and different central values. But, you know, the combination was a hopeful combination. And I don't think it was taken too seriously because we knew we would be tripling the data within next years.
Yeah, but the evidence for the Higgs particle is all based on Higgs decay products. They're only known experimentally to 20% at present.
You have another question?
So maybe what seems confusing about what George is presenting on the North Sky is that he's saying all the tensions go down. And I think as you pointed in the Higgs-Holmes divide, right, some of these tensions, the best explanation of some of these tensions may be pointing to some of these physics. So it's hard to, so what is your takeaway when George says he adds more sky? I mean,
right.
George, am I understanding the AL tension has gone down when you've added more sky?
Yes.
What I said in my talk is that when people are using these early dark energy things, they're using it to solve the Hubble tension between, you know, low and high, or late and early. But they're also looking at what is it doing to the CMB power spectrum itself. So the papers as of a few months ago were claiming a modest improvement in the CMB. That is a different statement, or even sort of unrelated to George saying, which I accept at face value, that internal tensions within the CMB look smaller when he adds more data. That doesn't mean that another model with a scalar field can't improve on the CMB fit, or that it's necessary, because what I said in my talk was it's not worse. I mean, adding ineffective, for example, makes the CMB fit worse. And so that's what I think disfavors it. Adding something that, let's say, solves a problem. If you thought that you knew some physics and that it solved this problem and it didn't make any fit, the fit to another data set worse, you'd be very happy. You would say, oh, it's agnostic about the CMB. The CMB doesn't have the leverage to care about that term. And so, you know, that can be the case of things that push the sound horizon or make it smaller. You know, people have been pointing out that there are observational clues of these scalar fields in the CMB. In this Hubble-Hunter's guide, I think Lloyd Knox said, we may be seeing some evidence of those because the CMB fit is getting a little better. I don't know if with George's larger data set, if that would still be true or not. They were basing it on the public
data. Yeah, that's something that we want to look at. You know, I mean, what I would argue with what we've done, you know, the chi-squared, a degree of freedom, is very close to one. So it's, you know, so you can't do much better than that. Okay. The lambda CDM fits the data. That's what I meant when I said that lambda CDM fits the data perfectly within the errors. If you had some, you know, theory that improved the chi-squared, then the chi-squared per degree of freedom would go down, you know, to below unity.
I would like to add a note of warning from the history of physics and astronomy.
Can I make a comment about the data on H0? Because, you know, I think, you know, we've got to a point where we really do have to take, you know, this discrepancy seriously, and, you know, because, you know, I think that you'd need multiple failures to, you know, you'd have to have, you know, all three distance anchors being wrong, for example, for unexplained reasons, or some, you know, multiple failures to get rid of the discrepancy. So
can I follow up on that, George? If you're going to make another point, or
no, that's.
That's very unlikely, but basically what you need is two systematic. Now, the third one, I'm not sure. So I guess you're talking about the lensing and supernovae, and what would be the third one? Yeah, you're talking about Maser?
Well, so he was talking specifically for, let's say, our distance ladder,
yeah.
That, you know, we have three different sources of calibrating it, and all of them give you the discrepancy. But an alternative view is, you know, something fundamentally wrong with, you know, Cepheids.
So that, that's right. So the specific, what if surface are just somehow very calibrating, they're different from 300 supernovae?
Yeah, so there, you know, you go in my matrix tension table and you get rid of Cepheid, and you're still at, you know, 4.5 sigma or something, because you use MIRAs and TRGB, you still have masers, you still have lensing, you still have surface brightness fluctuations. I mean, that's the problem is, you know, we're at a point where, I mean, I tried in that table to show there is no one thing you could eliminate on either side to do that. And so
you can, how about if you eliminate two things?
You eliminate two things. Then the
just
matrix becomes very difficult to look at. But yeah, why not eliminate all of them? I do it on the early universe side. I eliminate CMB and BAO.
I see the CMB that.
Summarize, and we have a first principles understanding of the value of the sound horizon as a function of cosmological parameters.
You can calculate the sound horizon with knowledge of the components of the plasma and their microphysics.
That's right.
Yes.
And so for, you know, these other stellar-based methods, do we have a first principles prediction for what the PL relation should be?
No, we have something even better. We have empirical evidence, right? when you look at a galaxy like the LMC, right? All the Cepheids are in it. Okay, so you know what the form of the periluminosity relationship is there because everything's co-located. When you look at another galaxy, you get cross-checks. When you look at, you know, 19 or soon 38 of these calibrators and you look at the relative distances Cepheids predict versus the relative distances supernovae predict, those agree very well. So you have lots of internal cross-checks that are empirical. I mean, yes, we have a very good understanding from pulsation theory that there ought to be a relationship between the luminosity and the pulsation frequency of a Cepheid. That's well understood. But we use the empirical value for that instead of a theoretical value.
But I mean, I think that the point here is
but
that
I wouldn't dispute any one astrophysical source. You know, I mean, what you're left sort of saying is for an astrophysical source, you're saying, what if all the Cepheids within 10 megaparsecs of us are different than the Cepheids beyond 10 megaparsecs? Okay. Or what if all the supernovae within 40 megaparsecs are different than the supernovae beyond 40 megaparsecs? This is ultimately how you break a distance ladder, or what the ultimate assumption in a distance ladder is you're saying, you know, when two things are co-located, one calibrates the other with just no complexity whatsoever. But I'm going to use this set of standard candles within one radius, and I'm going to then compare them to them at another radius. And so if between those radii, the objects are different. What's difficult about that, first of all, it's crazy, okay? I mean, it's crazy to say the supernovae within 40 megaparsecs are different than the ones beyond 40 megaparsecs, or the Cepheids. There's lots of galaxies within 10 megaparsecs. This isn't just our galaxy. But hold on, let me go further. We can eliminate any of these. As I said, you get one challenge, and we're still stuck with this problem. This is not stuck to one distance ladder. What about strong lensing? What do the time delays of quasars and strong lensing know about supernovae? And what do they know about masers in other galaxies? What do these things know about each other?
No, but the maser, the maser error is huge, so that's not really...
I did this formally by removing one thing. So my statement remains you can remove any one thing, including, you know, this is a peremptory challenge. You don't have to come up with a reason why.
I just want to point out that regarding the Fantasy-EDM model, there are three major questions about it. One is the restrictive symmetry, FRW. The other is the mystery of dark matter. The third is the mystery of dark energy. And also the fact that we use six parameters to fit the data. So let us recall that the Greek astronomer Ptolemy invented Ptolemaic astronomy in AD 550, and it produced a very accurate description of planetary astronomy for up to the time of the 16th century. But there were small discrepancies in the data that eventually overturned it due to Copernicus and Kepler, particularly Kepler. These tiny discrepancies are very important. And that's what we're talking about here with this tension. They can be important and really change the whole picture.
Let me ask a poll question just for fun, okay? A poll of the room. If we had a good theoretical explanation for this, a good one, one you would say that would seem very natural to occur, then would anybody have any doubt about it explaining what's going on?
I think that's a tough
probably not
to ask you
about.
Let me rephrase that. We had a possible explanation. It seemed very natural. Okay, but you know, we didn't know whether it was going on or not. It was just, you know, yeah, that may exist, that may not exist, like another particle or something, but a very, you know, straightforward one. There was no reason that it didn't exist. In fact, you know, we were going to set it by this experiment.
But that was the type of a bicep, right? Bicep, was, we had the very natural explanation, just happened to be the wrong explanation. I don't think that's a good...
But for the Higgs discovery, we were expecting something to bump up there as well, and
yeah,
then it bumped
so
up. So we believe
it's 50-50,
more,
right?
Yeah. It's hard to take a lift.
The explanation, if it explained the value of lambda, then that would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the cosmological constant problem.
Would
yeah.
we believe the discrepancy if we had a theory for
yes.
it? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I think those things should be
right.
separate.
And that's why I'm trying to
have
people think about it separately by saying, okay, right now you don't have the theory. I understand
and
that. If you didn't, would it make a difference? That's what I'm asking.
Well, yeah, when more things fit together,
there are different kinds of things, theory and observation.
The
right, right,
yeah.
right. I mean, I think we can do an experiment without having theory.
Yeah. Okay. So I think this.
We do lots of theory without
yeah.
experiment. Okay, could I be provocative?
Please, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So. So really, I mean, you know, in the sort of. You know, menu thing. I really think that there are only two good distinct H-null measurements. Okay, so either you go through you know distance anchors, nearby distance anchors, or you do strong lensing. Okay, and that's you know. So I think there are only those two methods for low redshift. The strong lensing measurements, I'm really suspicious about the strong lensing measurements because there's a degeneracy with external convergence. And now that they have six lenses, there's actually quite a strong correlation between the value of H naught that you infer and the external convergence that they assume for those lenses. So I think that degeneracy is really problematic. You know, is it possible that all of the distance anchor distances are wrong? You know, and then, you know, the problem goes away. So I think, you know, I respect what Adam's doing and what everybody's doing, but, you know, there's still a possibility of, you know, sort of catastrophic multiple failures.
Do you want to comment on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, if we're willing to go to catastrophic multiple failures, then, you know, catastrophic multiple failures, you know? I mean, I've been saying that as well, is we're at the point where it requires catastrophic multiple failures. You know, I measured parallaxes myself personally, you know?
Yes.
Two other groups measure parallaxes. Gaia has measured parallaxes now. You know, there aren't just... You know, and I look at it in many ways as five distance anchors, not three, because I know what it takes to measure parallax now. And, you know, they couldn't be more different in terms of the systematics involved. And so, you know, five catastrophic failures. Wow. You know, or, you know, the masers. I mean, I know the error bars are high, but, you know, if we're going to look at all the things, I mean, George, you said lensing, the nearby anchors, the masers all the way out, you know, is really neither of those. You know, again, you know, could all these things be wrong? Sure. I don't know. In the history of the universe, why not? But I don't hold lambda CDM on a kind of theoretical pedestal that I do with Maxwell's equations or something, where
I think that's right.
So I don't, you know, I don't put it at the same level. I see this still as a discovery science. And so we do the experiments with the real possibility that we're going to discover another feature in the universe. Not, you know, if I find that, you know, the opera experiment, I hope nobody hears from opera experiment, but that, you know, the neutrinos are traveling faster than light. And we go, oh, that's really hard. I don't put this in the same category. So I don't worry as much about multiple catastrophic failures. You know, maybe I should, but, you know, I do the best job we can in our experiment and many ways in our experiment. I look at the other experiments and I'm just reporting, I think, what seems obvious to me, which is that, you know, we have a very serious problem or opportunity, I should say, really opportunity, especially for theorists. I'm in a theory heavy place. You know, I think this should be really a lot of food for theory work.
So I think this is a great summary of the discussion of the
experiment. And it came out. A 1,000-page theoretical paper published in 6 months. The 750 GeV Higgs, which was 6 sigma, produced 800 papers in 4 or 5 months from the theorists. And they'd all vanished as soon as it was shown that the 750 GeV Higgs was a fluctuation.
Yes, but we've discussed this already, that there was like a different combination of data sets ignoring different widths and everything. So I think, yeah, this is on a different level, just because we have many different experiments.
George
here.
And I might agree on this.
Yeah.
Let me try this. I think, and I think George might agree with this, that theorists would not be wasting their time trying to solve this problem from a theoretical standpoint.
Sorry, did you say
that theorists would not be wasting their time, that this is serious enough that it merits the, you know, your actual time and effort to think?
I can tell you that they don't have anything better to do, so.
Yeah. This is very true.
Yes, no, I agree with that, Adam.
Yeah. Okay, so I think this wraps up the discussion very nicely. So just in case that anyone still wants to comment on any of the other discrepancies, any of the talks we heard about those yesterday, Jen, please raise your hand. Otherwise, I think we would end this discussion now, and I think the only thing, yeah, we can summarize is there is this discrepancy. We have several different data sets. We can combine them in various ways. The discrepancy doesn't go away, but we still don't have any convincing theoretical explanation. Maybe this will come up within the next year. So we will continue this discussion. It will not end now, I guess, for dinner and the next days and weeks and months and years. And yeah, so I thank you very much for joining the discussion, and thanks, George, for remotely joining and giving the talk. And have a nice evening.
Thank you, George.
Thanks.
Thank you.